Gary Knoll. You are listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. One day a week, we take on a serious topic, more often than not, one that has been either given very short attention by the mainstream or even alternative media. And we bring those individuals who have something constructive to share about the causes and, more importantly, the solutions that are necessary. Today, we are also combining conversations with remarkable minds. The topic, debt and poverty in America, and how corporate America and the financial elite benefit from our ever-increasing inequality gap. The reality is simple. 80% of the entire world population lives on less than $10 a day. That is a serious amount. Then when you consider that in some places gasoline is $3.75 for a meal, a simple meal, even a junk food meal, is $3 to $4, you see how challenging it is for most people. We're going to explore how this inequality has come and different contributors to it, not the least of which is global warming, which we don't seem to understand that as the environment becomes more precarious, it will absolutely impact the people who are least able to survive. My guest on today's program is Professor Frances Fox Piven. She is a professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, where she's taught for 30 years. She served as the president of the American Sociological Association until 2007, and prior to her arrival at City University, she was on the faculty at Boston University with Howard Zinn, Murray Levin, and much of her career has been a commitment to addressing those conditions leading to poverty. She also worked with her late husband, Richard Cloward, and became known as the Cloward-Piven Strategy, a plan to increase enrollment in social welfare programs designed to collapse a system that would force reforms leading to guaranteed annual income. She has been a lifelong social activist and public advocate. She's received many honors and awards and acknowledgments. She is also the author of some important works, including The War at Home, The Domestic Cost of Bush's Militarism. Her latest book is Who's Afraid of Frances Fox Piven, The Essential Writings of the Professor Glenn Beck Loves to Hate. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary.
I always give a little extended introduction and then really turn the program over to the guests, much like a classroom on the air. So please feel free to extend your comments as long as you wish.
And I first want to talk about poverty in the United States. You're correct to say that there are very serious poverty problems developing across the globe as a result of global warming. But an astonishing pattern has developed over the last 40 years. Poverty has pretty steadily increased. If you iron out the dips and humps that are the result of specific economic developments, poverty is steadily increasing. It's increasing both among working people and non-working people. And at the same time, we've been steadily cutting back the programs that were inherited from the New Deal and from the Great Society that were designed to relieve poverty. This is an astonishing pattern when you consider the amounts of wealth that have been accumulated in the United States and the fact that the United States is far and away the wealthiest country in the world, but we also have some of the worst poverty statistics in the world.
Okay, before we go further, we're going to ask you to hang up so we can call you back. We're having a little static on the line. And while that my engineer's reconnecting with you, let me just give an overarching introduction to this theme. Because before we go into the theme of poverty in the United States and some of the guiding principles of modern free market capitalism that has been a leading contributor to rising poverty, not just in the United States, but globally, I'd like to step back to the debates or conversations you had with Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago. Now, this was in 1980. So it was before the world had much evidence to judge the pros and cons of Friedman's specific economic neoliberal theory that would end up defining much of the economic policies of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. And although the entire Friedmanite and Chicago school roots can be traced back to deregulated capitalist agenda before the Great Depression and the New Deal, it's really Reagan where our current globalized model of free market capitalism takes shape at an institutional level, and it's clear we never learned our lessons. Now, it was Bill Clinton who dismantled much of the New Deal, and especially the Glass-Steagall Act, and that's directly contributed to our present economic crisis and recession. Now, even with Elizabeth Warren trying to reinstate Glass-Steagall again, we find President Obama at the opposite end of the spectrum eyeing Larry Summers for a possible position in his administration or at the Fed. And several years ago, when the University of Chicago announced that it was going to create a Milton Friedman Chair of Economic Studies, over 100 of the university's faculty protested and signed a petition to hold it. So I'd like you to begin by giving us your critique and commentary of the past 30-odd years since the day you debated Friedman on whether or not economic freedom contributes to great equality, social and financial well-being. And when we look back at the economic policies during these past 30 years, what has been the economic fairy tale and lessons we need to learn? The forum is yours.
Well, I think the term economic freedom is a kind of trick term. It means what people mean by economic freedom is the economic license, the lack of any kind of restraints on those who own resources, money, property, stock, whatever. And the economic freedom of most people would be increased if we restrained the people who are the owners, the accumulators, and the predators in market operations. So it's a trick term. We shouldn't use it. We should say that our freedom, the ability to use our talents, our assets, to develop social relationships, to live a decent life, our freedom depends on being able to restrain what the marketeers, the free market ideologues, call economic freedom. But you brought up Milton Friedman. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I worked as a clerk in the economics department at the University of Chicago, and that meant that Milton Friedman, a big-time professor, was one of my bosses. So I got to know him, and it was a sort of jocular and ironic relationship. And somehow, some years later, I was invited to be a guest on his 10-part series, funded, by the way, by major corporations, called Freedom to Choose, which was, in fact, a celebration of the free market. And two things about the series, one about the series and one about my own episode, the episode in which I participated. But the series was part of the sort of mythical, intensely ideological advertisement that business interests basically make of their rights, their rights to do whatever they want, no matter the risks that it creates for the real economy and the people who live in the real economy. Because this series depicted markets as little community bazaars, something like your lawn sale, something like your farmer's market. It was completely unrealistic, completely deceptive. It was so friendly, so attuned to ordinary people. You could tell what was going on. You knew what it was that you were buying because you could pick up the tomatoes and squeeze them. Now, you know, real economic life is not about going through the bazaar, going through the farmer's market and inspecting the goods. Most of what happens in the economy happens behind our backs, the backs of ordinary people, and it has to do with transactions in which we cannot intervene. So it's hoax. It was pure propaganda. Well, anyway, so I got a call from the We Love Milton Friedman Society or whatever it was at the University of Chicago. And I went back to my university to be on this show. And it was in Harper's Library, a library where I had studied. I, you know, curled up in a corner to read my assignments. And then the producer comes out and he tells me that I am not, he has one rule and it cannot be broken, that I cannot mention Chile in this show. Now, I mean, what kind of a, this is at a university, we're supposed to believe in free intellectual interchange. There are rules about what you can mention that, and what you can mention that has actually happened, that has involved millions of people, that has been a catastrophe for a you can't mention that. Anyway, I mentioned it anyway. I talked about it anyway. What did I care? He didn't have chains around me or you know, a bracket on my mouth or whatever. So, but it, you know, it still was a setup, very much so.
For the benefit of our listeners, I'd like to give some of the recent statistics. I've just returned from a major filming expedition for the seventh time in 5 years, filming the poor in America at all levels of society and how bad it really is, because we're not seeing these people anywhere represented in the media. We're not seeing the senior citizens who are poor. We're not seeing the highly educated who are poor, the tenured professors, or not tenured, but the adjunct professors who are bagging food in public supermarkets. We're not seeing any of this. So according to the Economic Policy Institute, half of Americans had no assets in 2009. Their debt exceeded their assets, and therefore, when Republicans and Tea Partiers claim the poor, or Romney's 47%, are parasites, half of Americans really have taken nothing. Then in 2011, 1 in 6 Americans were living below the official poverty level threshold of $22,811 per family of four, a figure recently increased by $400, by the way. And over 20 million are living in extreme poverty. And based upon wage figures from the IRS, half of Americans living at or at below the poverty level. That's well over 150 million Americans. And a recent OECD report say that, quote, inequality has increased more over the past 3 years than the previous 12 years, and the largest increases in the United States. We've seen the largest decrease in wages in the United States in 30 years. And based on household expense totals calculated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau, poverty is now creeping into that half of the Americans who were gainfully employed, or the upper middle class, or at least those who were okay with their jobs and had some security. Here's the latest statistic. A family making $60,000 a year will have income reduced by $15,000 for a total tax bill. $30,000 will go for food, housing, and transportation, and a total household expenditure of $50,000, which leaves them nothing for debt at all. So that's why then people are using their credit cards and kiting a lot of this debt. And they're just one, they're paying one credit card with another because there's nothing left to pay bills. But then it really gets bad because I've been filming for the last month children who are in dire poverty. And this statistic is staggering. Right now, 1.6 million children, when they leave school each day, have no home to go to. They're homeless. 16.4 million children, and that's 23% of all children under 5 live in dire poverty. And 3 million have have increased into that each year. One-third of all American children live in households without secure employment. And then, of course, there's a gap between wealth ownership of the haves and the have-nots, and which has gotten to obscene levels. So would you then, as a follow-up question, I'd like you to go into some of the in-depth and explain how the financial sector preys upon citizens, and particularly the poor, which in turn impoverishes them further. For example, we even find corporations benefiting financially from welfare programs. The food stamp program, now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is a market cornered by J.P. Morgan and an ACS, which is a computer service firm, and eFunds. So even food stamps to keep food on people's table has become an insider's game. And this is not a form of what Naomi Klein called shock or disaster capitalism. Your comments, please.
Well, I mean, first, I think that you have to put a kind of context on the horrendous numbers that you report. The United States, other countries also have large numbers of poor people. But the United States is the richest country in the world, measured in terms of GNP. And, of course, median incomes are quite high because the extraordinary incomes of the top 1% pull the median up. So this catastrophe is happening in the context of great wealth. It doesn't have to happen. It doesn't make any human sense. The second thing to be noted is that the United States has become a world leader in poverty, as you implied, but this is also a relatively recent development, that at least through the middle decades of the 20th century, we were making progress in reducing poverty in our country. The progress was not the result of the good intentions of our political leaders or anything of that sort. It was the result of the struggles in the 1930s of the unemployed and the labor movement and of old people. And it was the result also in the 1960s of the struggles of the Black Freedom Movement and the economic justice movements that the Black Freedom Movement kicked off. We made progress. And poverty in both the 1930s and the 1960s was very significantly reduced in our country. And the pattern that began to emerge after the 1960s, and analysts looked at the data and this is what they saw, is that poverty, even in the when the movement subsided, we had developed a pattern where poverty tended to increase during periods of economic high unemployment, but then it diminished when economic growth was restored. And you could be not delighted by that pattern, wasn't good enough, but at least there was something reassuring about it. We weren't getting worse. But for at least the last 35 years, we've been getting worse. The poverty that you're describing is not only the result of people who are not in the labor market. It's also in at the heart of the labor market. The American labor market, which in the periods between the 1930 and, say, 1975, included large numbers of stable, industrial, unionized jobs. That pattern has changed. There are no longer is the labor market dominated by full-time workers with secure employment, union protections, and so forth. Increasingly, we have a labor market dominated by what we call precarious workers, a lot of contingent workers, part-time workers, irregular workers. They get paid badly, and the bottom tenth of the working population has been losing ground. And not only are they paid badly, but they have absolutely no protection if they're laid off they lose their jobs, they're almost surely not covered by unemployment insurance. And while this has been happening, the politics of the country has taken a turn which has led to the rolling back of the protective programs that were first introduced into the New Deal. So that if you look at something like the welfare program, it now reaches one-third of the people that it reached before 1996 when Bill Clinton led us on the horrendous path of ending welfare as we know it. And increasingly, no matter what happens, the right wing mobilizes whatever the problem. The answer is to cut programs for the poor. And the Democrats are not good defenders of these programs. They're not vigorous defenders of these programs. They have a kind of mantra. If you get rid of those programs, get rid of the poor people, then you won't be attacked. Well, if you get rid of those programs, you get rid of poor people, get rid of enough poor people, you won't be in power either.
I would like to share a little different perspective on this, and then I'd like you to address my comments, please. I see a complete failure of the major leadership of the major unions in the United States over the last 15 years. Why? Because it was under the Democrats that Clinton was able to pass GATT, NAFTA, and the World Trade Organization. That caused 1.3 million American jobs to be lost and almost 1.5 times the amount in Mexico in dire poverty. I went down there and actually visited Mexico, and it was just the people were miserable. But also under Clinton and the acolytes like Robert Rubin, and then Larry Summers, and those people together with one Texas senator managed to eviscerate the Glass-Steagall Act. And then you look at Summers today, and this is a man now being considered, actively considered by Obama, either to come back in to his Council of Economic Advisors or to head the Federal Reserve after Bernanke. And at least we forget, before people get too excited about Larry Summers coming back as the so-called brightest guy in the room, he was the former Harvard professor and high-level Wall Street player. And was he not fired from Harvard because of his obscene comments about women as scientists? Didn't he diss black professors as inadequate scholars? Didn't he, personality defects aside, the Democratic Party had a huge stake in Larry Summers. And he became the head of the money-friendly corporate Democrats that have controlled the party since Bill Clinton. And there's no difference in what goes on today. So Summers came back to Washington 2009 as Obama's chief economic advisor, and he was the one who caused a lot of the problems we're seeing. And he also was the one that championed the Russian shock doctrine. And even now the Washington Post is giving him high praise and giving him op-ed columns that I find just pathetic. And yet, let us not forget that he's promoting himself now as a moderate liberal economist. He is not. And all of the stuff I see as being really a problem, the Democrats, many corporate Democrats and unions went along with. But then after they saw the disaster of these decisions and his eviscerating the social welfare programs and then giving everything to the corporate interest, then when Hillary runs, she runs on the same ideology as her husband. And there she is in Columbus praising NAFTA as if she's the union's best friend. She's the union's worst enemy. So where is the leadership? Why don't they wake up? Why hasn't there been general strikes? Why hasn't there been demonstrations? Why hasn't there been a top-down demand for some change? And yet there is not. Only one person stood up, one human being in that whole stupid race of those clowns, and that was Dennis Kucinich, who said he would completely abolish NAFTA. Now we've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership that is NAFTA on steroids, and no one is protesting, at least all the unions. And who do you think is going to be hit first? The unions. And then who's going to be impacted? All of the private sector will have public access unfettered, and yet the unions haven't done a damn thing. to march, to demonstrate. Now, those are my thoughts. I'd like yours, please.
Well, I don't know what you meant when you said you didn't agree with me. I certainly agree that both parties are dominated and corrupted by their ties to big money and their concern for, you know, just getting reelected. That's true of both parties. And I certainly agree that union leadership has become fat, lazy, and oligarchical. And now, for the last, I think they probably figured this out about 25 years ago, that they were on the defensive. But they haven't been willing to take risks in fighting for a comeback. But that doesn't mean that the rank and file in the unions don't have some potential, considerable potential for fight back. I think they do, but the leadership acts as a kind of constraint on that. And the same thing is true of people. Most people are not in unions. We only have, 7 or 8%, 6% unionized in the United States today. So that most of the fight back that has to come will not come and will not be led by these leaders, certainly not by Larry Summers, but it won't be led by Barack Obama either, because he also is tied. He's tied to his own psychology, which makes him rather timid, but he's tied to the big money funders of his party and to the old line incumbents in his party. It's not going to be led by Barack. It's not going to be led by Larry. It's not going to be led by the AFL-CIO union leadership. It's going to be a pushback against them if it occurs. I think it has to occur, and I think it will occur, actually, or we are in for a very, very difficult downward trajectory of the American empire. But people do rise up. And usually it is not either the party leadership or the union leadership or other elites who are in the forefront. They rise up against these leaders.
The only time I believe we're going to see anyone in America rise up is if their televisions go off line for a couple of days. I just don't see what the rest of the world is doing as being concomitant with our needs. But there is another issue that I think is essential that we understand. I have the advantage of counseling a lot of different people. Over 70,000 people I've counseled for health-related issues. Now, a certain small percentage of those are very wealthy people, and some are hedge fund people, and I don't really care what they do. If they have a problem, I'm there to help them. But in the nature of conversations, if they discuss any of this stuff, I'm always interested in the answer they would give me. And I ask them, why do you need this amount of money? You have $7 billion. Why? When the people who work for you are getting squeezed. And why is it that if you're running a corporation, why don't you look at what would happen if you started to give a percentage of your profits to the workers who can spend more, because they would have more within their communities, and therefore a dollar would go about 67 times around a community, where today it goes around 11, and the poor it even goes less. And wouldn't it make sense then to have some stability? And time and again, and just this past week, I spoke with one of the most financially powerful women in the world, in the whole world, and she said something interesting. She said, "You are right. There's no need for more money. But there is a need for more power. Because those people who seek power and seek it either through their celebrity status or the success in business or however they're doing it, they're basically insecure people. And once they have the benefit of being acknowledged for having achieved something, it becomes like an opiate to them. They can't give it up. And so they have to go back every day, and then they stop seeing people for being human beings. They start seeing them as objects." And this person said, "Look, everyone I know, and this person knows all the power players, Henry Kravitz and Silverstone and Black. So this person says, well, these people are just people, but they're all insecure. So no matter how much money they make, they've got to show that they can squeeze every dime out of it and leave no money on the table, which means, for those who don't understand, they're not willing to ever do something that actually establishes some equality in their negotiations. So the business model today that we have, and Wall Street is put on the altar, is don't care about anything except how much profit you have given back to your shareholders and then to the executives at the top. Well, what about your workers? We don't care. What about the consequences to people you've exploited, like in Bangladesh to make your dresses or in China to make your cell phones? We don't care. All we care about is, as long as we're profitable, we'll be top dogs. And so you're looking at, I feel, as a deep sociopathic tendency in many of the individuals who control the body politic, control corporate banking and other interests, who are disconnected at a human level from the consequences of their money. And that includes people, by the way, who are the darlings of the left, like George Soros, who I consider one of the most reprehensibly amoral people on the planet, because when he makes his money and gives it liberally to the left, they kiss his ass instead of looking at him for what he is. You know, when he traded in currencies and suddenly the people, millions of Russians, went hungry, and millions of people in Mexico went hungry, he didn't care. He was lauded and praised. Just the blindness of these ideologues on both sides and the need for people to have more and more and more, it bothers me. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, I don't. I think you're describing, you can call it a pathology, but there are so many precedents for it in human history, for this kind of insatiable greed for power or wampum or money or whatever. And I don't think that that is ever redressed by curing or counseling or whatever, soothing the people who have this kind of insatiable ambition. I think they can only be pushed aside. And maybe that's usually only temporary. Maybe the kind of human urge for power and money or power and resources always reasserts itself. So it always has to be constrained. You can never cure it once and for all. But, you know, I'm not going to try to cure or counsel or argue with a Larry Summers. I just don't want him in power, and I want to try to work to prevent him from acquiring the power positions that he wants. And I think the same thing was true of the Rockefellers, of Henry Ford, of the Fricks, of all of the, you know, evil geniuses that shaped American society. If to the extent that they have been restrained, and they have been restrained, it was never by counseling them or ministering to them or dealing with their inner restlessness or insatiability. They were restrained by setting limits on what they could do, and those limits were established by resistance, popular resistance.
And you're absolutely correct. The problem is there is no resistance to the changes. The Trans-Pacific Partnership will eliminate all these trade barriers they previously had. That through ALEC, the American Legislation and Exchange Council, they passed over 20,000 bills in the last 30 years, 800 in the last year alone. All of that is meant to give them more leeway in exploiting things at the state level without state laws interfering. So they have it on their side. They have the power. And everyone that they bring to the table is one of them. No matter what their background, they're easily co-opted. You don't get into a position of power in Washington. You don't get invited to be the economic advisor of the president unless you're willing to go along with what they're saying. So I just don't believe that there's going to be, unless there's a total collapse, and I hate to say this, but unless there's a total fiscal collapse, which could happen if China and the BRICS nations start trading exclusively in their own currencies instead of the dollar, that could cause a real challenge to the dollar's value when it's no longer the official reserve currency. And then, and only then, when things just implode, maybe we'll wake up. But I have a separate issue for you that is absolutely the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room. And that is the crisis we are now facing that is only going to get worse on the impact of climate change and global warming, and increased corporate exploitation of land and resources upon the economic stability and any hope to lessen the inequality gap and poverty. In poor developing nations, we see repeatedly how globalization's adverse impact upon the environment worsens poverty and social conditions. And the deforestation of the Himalayas increases the severity of floods in Bangladesh. And land grabs in Africa force rural farming villagers who were living sustainably, though poor, into homelessness and to migrate to larger cities where they fill the slums. In what ways is the pattern seen in developing countries now being enacted here?
Well, it is to some extent. I mean, the climate patterns in Arizona, I don't know if they have anything to do with the lurch to the right in Arizona, but certainly there are signs of a widespread drought in parts of this country, and Arizona would be the center of that. But by and large, I think that the United States is not yet affected by climate change, and it's not affected. It hasn't affected our patterns of class, anxiety, problems, antagonisms in the way that you describe. But certainly that is the scenario that we have to expect in the future. Hundreds of millions of people are being affected by resource depletion, by the inundation of their land, who have to migrate. And actually, some of that is affecting the United States. It now occurs to me that the droughts in Mexico may be a major push factor in creating immigrants who try to cross the border, that the United States erects fences, both legal and literal. The scenario that you're pointing to is so huge and so awesome that it's hard to get your mind around it. It's a transformation of the globe that is going to affect the southern hemisphere much more significantly and much more quickly than the northern hemisphere, and produce, you know, eons of struggle, catastrophe that we can hardly imagine. The immediate connection to the problems of poverty in the United States, well, they're not very close, those connections. They may be in the future. There's something else that you often talk about that has a lot more to do with poverty in the United States, and that is the sort of, you might say, pioneering ventures by the financial community to squeeze money out of the poor, something that has developed over the last 25 years or so. One part of the pattern is that poor people and increasing numbers of working poor people are turned to credit as a way to stay afloat. On the one hand. On the other hand, the financial industry, the credit card companies, deluged everybody with promises of cheap credit. I mean, how many advertisements have you gotten in the mail offering you a new credit card? Quite a few, I imagine. They've also made it possible for people who could not afford mortgages to take out mortgages. And then once they make these people into debtors, big-time debtors, actually, they then squeeze them using the culture which makes the debtor status a shame, and using the courts to get money out of these people. And, of course, the same thing has happened to many university students. We should not charge money for higher education. It should be a public service. And even the universities that were begun as public services, that were begun as public universities, now charge high tuition. And high tuition means that students become another class of debtors who can then be squeezed by the predator creditors. And, you know, the sort of the final irony of this is that, you know, people sometimes turn to crime as a way of surviving, then they get incarcerated, and then they accumulate new debts, the debts that are imposed by the criminal justice system for their food and board while they were in jail.
Unless very drastic and dramatic measures and policies are taken, for example, re-regulation of banks and private industries, and then reversing certain policies that have added more financial suffering on people rather than relieve it, what do you foresee as being the most important areas in the lives of average Americans where economic pressure and struggles will increase and continue to fuel rising poverty?
Well, you know, Gary, I think that people at the bottom of American society sometimes make progress in the sense that the onerous conditions of their lives are relieved a little bit, or they win rights in the workplace, or they win protections against workplace hazards, or they win relief or welfare or food stamps or whatever, child care subsidies. They do that. This happens when they rise up, when they pose a threat of ungovernability to the predators who are running the system. I look back over American history. I think that's the only way that it's those episodes in which we become a somewhat more humane society. And, you know, we have a long way to go to reverse the retrograde policies that have been imposed over the last 50 years. And we have to go further than that, because now we also confront the dangers of climate change. And those dangers are really huge and ominous, and they really require a transformation of the capitalist system, and also, by the way, of the socialist systems as we have known them.
One of the ways that global warming absolutely affects Americans today is in the storms that we're seeing. Last year we had 11,000 what are considered extreme weather events, meaning the worst of their kind in history, the hottest days, the coldest days, the most rain, the worst hurricane for that hitting New York and all the others. Well, now you have peak water, and the corporate American interests are now trying to buy the water rights everywhere so that you will have to pay them for having water at the very time when thousands of farms are running out of water because of the overdrawing of water from the great Ogallala and some of the other great aquifers in America. That's the largest one in the United States, covers 7 states. And I'm out there and I'm filming farmers that had a 1,000-acre wheat farm. Today, it's grass because they can't get the water up. It's weeds. And we're not addressing what's happening to the small farmers. Now, not the large corporate farmers, but the smaller farmers are running out of water. And then the extreme temperatures from global warming, from industrial America's, you know, constant use of the wrong fuels, including the carbon burning like coal. And as a result of that, 2 degrees increase in the summertime, and wheat will be stunted, corn will be stunted, and we're seeing drastic reductions in some states in the type of product they're growing. So there is a consequence when people don't have what they historically had and taken for granted. And I'm not blaming corporate America alone for this, because when you talk with farmers, did you ever think that your soil needed replenishing, that you're down to like 2 inches of topsoil and you started with a foot and it takes 1,000 years to create an inch? They were oblivious to it. As one farmer said, look, as long as we're paid to, you know, raise 1,000 acres of soybean, we're going to raise 1,000 acres of soybean. If we have to push it, we have to push it. Yeah, but in pushing it, you've also created dead zones at the base of the mountain Mississippi. One is the size of New Jersey, where nothing can exist in because there's no oxygen. That's due to chemical fertilizer. And then you got genetic engineering and trying to dominate the American food production with genetically engineered crops from Monsanto and DuPont. And so I'm seeing the relationship between major corporations, government policymakers, agreeing to everything they decide to do, even the Supreme Court.
Especially the Supreme Court lately.
Yeah, it's terrible. So could you address, in the last part of our program here, I'd like for you to address some things that are important. And one is, you were a large supporter of Occupy Wall Street when it erupted in downtown Manhattan. In just a short period of time, we'll be back to September 17th, and it'll be another anniversary for when people gathered in Zuccotti Park to protest against the greed of Wall Street. Do you see signs of a renewal at the national level to protest against the banking and corporate interest? And then what do you see as solutions for relieving poverty in the United States? Or possibly have we reached a threshold where the system is just too corrupt for implementing the kind of true constructive regulatory changes that will make a difference in providing great economic equality and economic freedom?
Well, I think that even the most optimistic forecast would depend on foreseeing a period of real tumult, disorder, and wildness in American society. Because, as you suggested, you know, we're all part of the system. We all cooperate in it. If we think we can get a job, get a raise, buy some more stuff, use our credit card to buy it, what ultimately we have to look for is the transformation of a culture which is absolutely gripped by the ideology of more, 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 which demands economic growth. We don't really need economic growth. You talked about the woman you talked to who had, what, $7 billion or whatever it was. She didn't need the $7 billion, but nevertheless, she wanted it. Well, so many of us are part of a culture which depends not on what we need, but what we want. We're part of a race for more, more, more. But I don't think that cultural transformation is going to occur without a vast and long-lasting movement. Occupy represented, I think, something of the image of what that movement could be. It was a movement that it was inclusive, it was a movement that was bold, and it was a movement that was willing to share. It was a movement that was willing to consider alternative ways of producing, of distributing economic resources. And we need, that movement has not died. That movement has now become part of our genetic code. And I see signs that the movement that began with Occupy, although it's always hard to say when a movement begins, the movement began with Occupy. Nevertheless, it's welling up among low-wage workers in Walmart, in the fast food industry, and it has to spread. It has to gain traction. And in the course of that movement, I hope we will discover alternative ways of organizing our lives, of finding purpose in our lives, and of organizing the elementary things that we have to do in order to eat, in order to have shelter, in order to raise our children, in order to have the level of security that human beings need to have and should have. But it's going to be a long, hard struggle. It will be a long, hard struggle, but it will not happen without struggle.
That's a very unique insight, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. To close out our program, I'm going to quote a short piece from Nation of Change, Christina Sarich, and it's entitled Poverty is a Weapon of Mass Destruction and the Economic Policies That Loaded the Chamber. And then I'd like your final comments on this. More than 80% of the entire world population lives on less than $10 a day. Even if you live in a country where a gallon of gasoline doesn't cost you around $3.50, and McDonald's Happy Meal, one of the worst and most nutritionally deficient but arguably cheapest meals around, costs you about $5, that leaves you $2 or some change to eat another meal, pay rent and medical expenses, and perhaps buy your 7-year-old a birthday present. That small amount of money might leave your pocketbooks feeling a little empty. In truth, it's the recipe for poverty, and it hasn't happened by accident. To the majority of people in the world, it was planned and executed with steely perfection by the 2% at the top of the corporate food chain. Some top-down economists will blame the poor in the United States as if they are a class of their own for being lazy, or that the single moms are to blame for having so many children out of wedlock that they have to apply for help from the state, draining taxpayer funds. Still others will say that world populations are just used to being working class and aren't intelligent enough to garner jobs which pay higher wages. You would think that with the invention of the internet, someone in Bangladesh or Laos would be able to make a middle manager earning as long as they had similar skills. This is simply not the case. Behind the increasing interconnectedness promised by globalization are global decisions, policies, and practices. These are typically influenced and driven or formulated by the rich and powerful. These can be leaders of rich countries or other global actors, such as multinational corporations and institutions and influential people. In the face of such enormous extreme influence, the governments of poor nations and their people are often powerless. As a result, in the global context, a few get wealthy while the majority struggle. Now, this doesn't even take into consideration the cost of wars, which are waged over illusionary issues to control natural resources, and the poverty that ensues in countries that are damaged by war's effects. Global poverty is highlighted in our own country and explained well in a Senate-issued Levin Coburn report. It states that the 2007-08 financial crisis, which we are still recovering from, was not a natural disaster, but the result of a high-risk, complex financial products, undisclosed conflicts of interest, and the failure of regulators, the credit rating agencies, and the market itself to rein in excesses of Wall Street. In 2007, more than 91% of AAA mortgage securities were downgraded to junk status. This means an investment that was once thought to be as right as rain was now as sound as a drunken night in Vegas, the roulette tables. This security went from AAA to Z overnight. The sad truth is that the market makers knew they were junk investments all along. Looking back, if any single event can be identified as the immediate trigger of the 2007 financial crisis, it would be mass downgrades. Those downgrades hit the market like a hammer, making it clear that they had been a colossal mistake. Credit raters and banks knew all along those investments were junk and would tank. An interesting study from Stanford University on a sovereign national fiscal responsibility index collaborates these assertions, saying banks and brokers, quote, deliberately misrepresented by the players. Now, the Stanford study compared 34 nations that belonged to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development and the so-called BRIC nations, the emerging financial powers of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Fiscal responsibility was measured in the study by various factors, including revenue rules, tax laws, international and national debt, and so forth. All 34 nations, as well as the BRIC nations, were shown to participate in the methodological stripping away of the middle class and the widespread creation of poverty. What is even more disheartening is that the more a person struggles with poverty, the more they are often marginalized from society and given a little voice or representation in larger political debates and the lawmaking that affects their state of wealth. This can make the American dream the impossible hogwash for many, and as far as the international poverty standards are concerned, extraordinarily difficult to rise above the man on less than $2 a day. In the U.S., in conclusion, the more poor there are, the easier it is for lawmakers to pass bills that promote corporate greed and million-dollar bonuses while ignoring gross negligence when it comes to fiscal responsibility. The same is true in other nations. If the CEO gets paid an average of $7,000 an hour, or 350 times his own workers, it could be said that those running our corporations are more like slave owners than fair contributing members of society. For example, the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, has a total annual compensation of $101 million, which breaks down to $48,000 per hour, or $809 per minute. It isn't laziness that causes worldwide poverty. It is the disenfranchisement of millions through the perpetuation of corporate greed. Even the mega corporations of Ben & Jerry's, makers of the popular ice cream, once had a 5-to-1 board member ruling that the CEO would be limited to 5-to-1 ratio of earnings over his lowest paid worker. But the company ditched this practice when they couldn't find anyone to replace Ben Cohen. The CEO worked for just $81,000 a year. At $2 a day, that's still $80,000 more than billions who people earn every year. And only the poor die young. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I think there is one point that we have not talked about. I think we would agree that our future, our country, our planet, our human race, our future depends on putting a halt to the predations that have run wild in the last 40 years, the neoliberal era. It's not that just our society or societies across the globe were just before this period, but the stripping away of whatever regulations we had, the unleashing of predatory greed has made things much worse and much more dangerous.
You're absolutely right.
I want to come back to the poor. And I think the situation of the poor in our country makes the point I want to make much more vivid. The poor are consequential or significant in this, not only because they are the main victims of a predatory system run wild, but also because once they are pushed down, made hungry, degraded, excluded, they can become a kind of scapegoat, a kind of sort of welfare queen writ large, which leads other people who are close to poverty or are afraid of poverty or are afraid because they're going to lose their homes. It enfeebles them as well.
You are absolutely right. Professor Piven, we're out of time. Thank you very much once again for coming on. My guest, Professor Francis Fox Piven, author of Who's Afraid of Francis Fox Piven, The Essential Writings of Professor Professor Glenn Beck Loves to Hate. I'm Gary Nall. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour and Conversations with the Remarkable Minds. Thank you very much.